Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Modern Money Smart Pod. I'm Colin Hogan.
And I'm Sean McMahon.
You know, we thought we'd take a different approach with this episode as we wind down the year and take a moment to look back on the seven most interesting stories we've seen as finance editors at Smart Brief this year.
That's right. We're going to call this the Smart Brief 7. And as Colin mentioned, these are the stories that we found most interesting. We're not going to claim that these are the most important stories in finance or, you know, the most clicked on stories or the most scandalous. These are just the stories that when we look back on 2021, Colin and I will remember these stories the most.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. But before we get started, here's a quick word from the exclusive sponsor of today's episode, ICE.
Environmental, social, and governance issues are in the spotlight. Investors need the markets, data, and indices to understand how their decisions impact the planet, people, and their portfolios. ICE provides data, markets, and analytics to help you measure performance, manage risk, and connect to opportunity. For more information, visit ice.com/connect to ESG or click on the link in the show notes.
All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us. As we mentioned during the intro, today we're going to have a little bit of fun. Colin and I are going to wrap up 2021 with a look back at the seven stories that we think were the most interesting of 2021. Are you ready for this, Colin?
I'm ready.
All righty. So, looks like I'm first up. Number seven. Remote work in financial services. Needless to say, the pandemic started a trend of remote work that some people thought would be temporary, but it seems to have lasted a little longer than that, Colin.
I would say so, yeah. I think a lot of companies are really reexamining where they're going to go from here in terms of hybrid work or remote work or back to the office, and Wall Street especially. A little wishy-washy on that.
Yeah, it seems like there's been some false starts in terms of returning to the office and then maybe not. One thing I did notice, though, is a lot of the big banks were kind of on the leading edge of vaccine requirements, you know, either making their staff get vaccinated, or I think it was Goldman Sachs that even told clients, like, if you want to set foot in one of our buildings, you got to be vaccinated. So that was interesting. Another aspect of the remote work that I'm kind of keen to keep my eye on is compliance. I mean, we're talking about an industry that had employees who had trouble following the rules when they were working in the office. And now we're supposed to all believe that, you know, suddenly working from home, you know, they might have resisted the temptation to do some things they weren't supposed to do. And anyone who works in compliance will tell you that it's been more difficult to track everyone's activities remotely. So it'll be interesting to see if there's any, you know, follow-up investigations or probes into misconduct during the pandemic, or if, you know, the regulators are just going to take what we call a light touch and kind of look the other way, except for the most massive and the most important misdeeds. So that's remote work. That's number seven. Colin, number six on our list, I'll throw it over to you.
Yeah, for number six, I think we need to take a look back on the Paycheck Protection Program. You know, this was, of course, something that rolled out in 2020 in response to the pandemic, but reopened again really early in 2021 and then was extended even, you know, supposed to run through the end of March, got extended through May. And this time around, smaller banks were kind of given a leg up after the program had faced a bit of criticism in the first iteration that bigger banks had the advantage. This really matters because, you know, at that point, small businesses still needed to be submitting their applications through a bank. That changed later on this year, but they were really given kind of a head start to smaller lenders, with bigger lenders shut out of the first few weeks or so. So that was a really interesting development and interesting how the government kind of tried to level the playing field there. The story that started to emerge, though, is how fintechs were able to really kind of start processing these applications faster and get these applicants their money faster than traditional lenders. And so you started to see, at a time when fintechs are really battling it out with banks for market share, a story about how they may have a competitive edge over the traditional lenders.
But wasn't there a little bit of trouble on the back end of that in terms of the due diligence from some of these fintechs? Didn't they get a little bit of trouble?
They did. So you fast forward to August and you see a study published by the University of Texas at Austin that found about 15% of loan applications probably had fraudulent information, to say the least, and that fintechs had processed about half of all those suspicious applications. And what's more, you know, when it comes to specific lenders who had a high rate of suspicious loans, 9 of the top 10 were fintechs.
So you're telling me that some of the fintechs don't quite have the massive army of underwriters and compliance officials that some of the legacy banks do?
Right. You know, the tech brings speed, but does it bring thoroughness? That's kind of an open question. You know, that's a big deal in this case, especially because we know, you know, about 3/4 of paycheck protection loans have been forgiven now. So this isn't even just potential fraudulent applications for money that was going to need to be paid back, but just complete government handout that was not really having much due diligence in some cases.
Just kind of vanished into thin air, we'll say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll see if the fintechs get things in under control and optimize their processes going forward. Maybe they learn from it, or maybe they'll just wait to get bought by a big bank and let the big bank handle the underwriting part of it.
Right, yeah.
Alrighty, so number 5 on the Smart Brief 7 here. We're just going to call this the push and pull between Wall Street and China. Throughout the year, there were a number of stories where it seemed like there was going to be more engagement with, you know, U.S. banks in China and then pullback, you know, and then more engagement and then pullback. We saw that in the exchange space where a lot of U.S. exchanges issued warnings to Chinese companies about disclosure and kind of telling them that they needed to see more information about their operations. But then we also saw it on the Chinese side of it, where, you know, China made it very clear here towards the end of the year that they would just perhaps very much appreciate that Chinese banks would list on Chinese exchanges. So a little bit of back and forth there. Also, you know, over the years, there's been a lot of these joint ventures between U.S. institutions and Chinese entities. And now we've seen some of those U.S. institutions get the green light from Chinese regulators to set up their own operations. So I think that's, you know, an opening of China more than a pullback.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of some Wall Street banks starting to get approval to join a Chinese company in a securities venture there. Others are now getting full control of their existing joint ventures with Chinese companies. So it's like Wall Street had its foot in the door in 2020 and is now kind of pushing a little further in. Though at the same time, like you said, with exchanges and on the U.S. end, we're kind of cracking down on Chinese companies listing in the U.S. as well. So, and maybe one of the biggest developments to come out of Chinese markets that's affecting U.S. companies and companies all over the world is the default of these major companies in China dealing with China's real estate sector, which has really had a worldwide impact on markets.
And finally, the last note on China that, you know, again, we're talking about the open and closing part of it, is people forget that Jack Ma just kind of disappeared for a couple of weeks there, right?
Or gone.
There's a period of time where the face of one of the biggest companies in the world, no one could find him.
Can you imagine if Jeff Bezos got into a sort of, you know, little public dispute with the U.S. government and then all of a sudden disappeared for a month or however long? A really huge story that, you know, we certainly followed, but still don't have a ton of answers on where he went for that time or, you know, why he laid low and what prompted him to lay low for that long.
Yeah, and Colin, I do have to point out, I do think that Jeff Bezos disappeared from the face of the earth for at least a few minutes there this year.
Yeah, we do know that he left the earth for a while. He did disappear from the face of the earth for a while, but with TV cameras on him the whole time and his unique spacecraft.
Yeah, exactly. So obviously, we will continue to keep an eye on the relationship between, you know, Wall Street and China. It's going to continue to evolve for years and decades, but this year just seemed to have a few big stories coming out of that relationship. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, Colin and I will continue our countdown of the Smart Brief 7.
Environmental, social, and governance issues are in the spotlight. Issues like climate change, diversity, and data privacy have growing influence across the investment cycle, from assessing exposure to allocating capital and achieving sustainability goals. Investors need markets, data, and indices to help them understand how their decisions impact the planet, people, and their portfolios. ICE provides quality data, analytics, and markets to help you measure performance, manage risk, and connect to opportunity. For more information, visit ice.com/connect to ESG or click on the link in the show notes.
And now back to the Smart Brief 7 for 2021.
In our number 4 spot, I think we need to talk about the end of SPAC mania, which came to a head this year after a lot of momentum since 2019. You know, the frenzy of SPAC deals that we saw last year kind of continued into the first quarter, but then we saw a pretty sharp drop off in the second and third quarters. And a lot of it probably stemming from news about litigation issues and the potential for more scrutiny from regulators on these deals.
Yeah, it seems like, especially in recent weeks, some of the stories have been based on SPACs being started up for entities that Let's just say the market viability of them is in doubt by many, many large sectors of investors. Some people might think I'm talking about the Trump administration and their tech and media SPAC, but we can also talk about BuzzFeed, right? Mm-hmm. BuzzFeed's a media entity. They went the SPAC route. Recent reporting is indicating that a lot of the employees there who were, you know, major stockholders because they, you know, were working for this cool, hip, upstart media company and for not as much money as they could be making, you know, they were hoping they'd get paid out on the back end with equity. There was a lot of troubles just in executing the trading of their shares. Continental, I think, was the company that was handling it. And some fiery words from the CEO of BuzzFeed about essentially their employees having their stock locked up because they couldn't get the paperwork done in time to trade it. And by the time they did, price in those shares had plummeted quite a bit. So definitely seems like there's some lessons learned there, especially as one of the reasons these entities go the SPAC route is to cut costs and speed the process. But maybe they're cutting too many corners, don't you think, Colin?
It was certainly a raw deal for the BuzzFeed employees. And you see now, you know, a lot of the anticipation of potential new rules and stuff starting to materialize with the SEC saying this month that calling on SEC staff to put together some new rules to ensure that SPAC investors have the same information at their disposal and the same protections as traditional IPO investors.
Exactly. So I think that's a trend that we will see definitely tail off. You know, we've seen the rise, and now I think we are in the middle of witnessing the fall of that SPAC trend. So moving down the list to number three on our list of the top seven stories of 2021, we're going to call it the rise of ESG investing. Now, obviously, ESG investing started before 2021, but this year saw it gather momentum at a blistering pace. In fact, some estimates say that by 2025, the ESG market will be worth $50 trillion. That's trillion with a T. So really, the question is this boom going to last? What do you think, Colin?
Well, I mean, there's no denying the growth spurt of this year. And with the developments we've seen come out of COP26, it's hard to imagine it doesn't continue, whether there could be a plateau that might make sense to a lot of people. But, you know, this is definitely the year where ESG investing and concern over greenwashing became top of mind for everyone, whether institutional or just individual investors or companies looking to raise money. Everyone's now got it right on the front of their mind.
That's exactly it. Anyone who's listened to this podcast knows that all of our episodes have pretty much had some kind of angle on ESG or sustainable investing. And so it's a hot area of the market. Lots of murkiness there, though, in terms of what constitutes, you know, an E, an S, or a G investment. Seems like there's a lot of people in there trying to take advantage of that by attracting money without much accountability. And truthfully, on the back end, there's not really a punishment apparatus for companies that don't meet these goals they set up that lured the money in, right? Or the punishment is such a small dollar amount that they're better off just taking the money and attracting the investors and then paying, you know, a fraction of the cost on the back end if they ever get held accountable at all.
Yeah, definitely still a lot of cracks to fill in, but we know we can expect to see more rulemaking and more standardization in the coming year after all we've seen come out of COP26 and just from the industry and regulators this year.
All right, now, Colin, we're shifting into the top two on our list of the top stories of 2021. And I got to be honest, I kind of went back and forth on these two. It was pretty close.
Really, really tough to pinpoint which is bigger and which is more important. But, you know, for number two, I got to say it is the crypto market and how it has matured in 2021. Obviously, it was gathering a lot of steam in 2020, the price of Bitcoin leading the way. But this was the year it really hit a growth spurt. And while individual investors have been huge drivers of this all along, I think we need to point out that this was the year we saw major institutions on Wall Street and elsewhere start to change their tune on this asset class.
Yeah, you know, as someone who's been to a lot of the industry conferences over the last decade or decade and a half, I can remember back to the early days where, you know, a lot of evangelists of crypto would show up at these events and the more tenured attendees would kind of roll their eyes and mock them a little bit. And they'd be stuck on some side panel, some small room way away from the main stage. And that all changed a few years ago. And now I think it's completely changed. I think your main headliners at some of these events and the most, you know, the panels and discussions that draw the most attendees will be based in crypto. There's a knowledge gap there. And everyone's trying to learn more. Like you said, a lot of the institutions are now kind of coming into it and coming into it kind of in a big way. But the industry itself is kind of starting to evolve as well. I mean, Coinbase went public. That's big. Binance has exploded, you know, and they're kind of in this this gray area too, where they were trying to be decentralized, you know, and now they're understanding that, you know, from a compliance and a legal perspective, that's not really going to work. A lot of regulators around the world have let them know that that's not going to work. And so they're trying to locate a headquarters. And I got to say, I was kind of surprised. The news came out that it looks like they're not going to end up in Singapore. I was putting a little bit of money on Singapore being one of the places that they would end up. I know they're looking at Ireland and a couple of other places, but it just seemed like Singapore would be a good fit. So we'll see where Binance ends up setting up its HQ. But that's just another example of an industry that's maturing, as you said, and also the acceptability of it. I mean, 2021 was the year when Tesla and Elon Musk, they started accepting Bitcoin payments for Teslas. And then when the backlash came from the environmental side about how, you know, the damage and how unfriendly to the environment Bitcoin mining is, you know, Elon stopped taking payments for Teslas in Bitcoin and then very quickly started taking payments again. So it's just this headline grabbing thing where people first can and then can't and then can again buy a car with Bitcoin.
Well, you know, it's not just Tesla too, you know, PayPal, Visa, other companies are starting to offer it in a way that almost starts to legitimize it as a currency and not just an asset for speculation. You know, if you can buy it on your payments apps and then conduct payments on your payments apps, that's almost like using Bitcoin as a currency. Many big strides this year for that.
And I think we've seen the derivatives market kind of step in as well. I mean, we've seen some cryptocurrency ETFs and stuff get launched. And so there's all kinds of momentum. But then the flip side of it is there's other jurisdictions where there's been a lot of pushback. I mean, China has just outright banned purchase of some goods and services with cryptocurrency. So it'll be interesting to see how the world continues to have altering views on cryptocurrency.
Yeah. Meanwhile, after China decides that crypto activity is illegal, El Salvador adopts it as a legitimate currency. So the contrast is huge, but also really kind of signals that there are jurisdictions out there that really want to take this seriously. And that's going to lift the tide for a lot of other jurisdictions too. So that brings us now to our number one story from the past year. Are you ready, Sean?
Drum roll, please. I'm ready, Colin. Reveal the big winner to our listeners.
Okay, I think they could probably deduce by now since we haven't talked about it, but we have to talk about the GameStop frenzy and meme stocks and what that has meant for markets. This, I think, we have to call the biggest story of the year because of what it means for the democratization of markets and also on the institutional side, how they are going to adapt to, you know, newer, maybe a little less disciplined trading happening in markets in a big way.
You nailed it with that term, democratization of markets. You know, I've been working with a couple of the big exchanges around the world for a number of years now, and many of them have been working to try and educate retail investors on things like options. A couple of years ago, they said, hey, we're going to push options and bring retail traders into this marketplace because we think there's room for growth. Well, guess what? Retail investors found out about options. And so that really kind of drove things crazy. I remember friends of mine just walking around, checking their phones, checking their, you know, their AMC and their GameStop holdings and asking me what's going on. I'm like, well, you know, I'm not going to say if it's going up or down, but it was just crazy that these are not professional traders. These are not even day traders. These are people that have other jobs and they just kind of want to get in on this frenzy. And there was all kinds of stories about, you know, the Reddit army and, you know, the Wall Street Journal did a big feature on one of the people they think was with the generals of that army. But at the end of the day, like that whole side of the equation in the markets has now, you know, the more institutional side has to pay attention because they're going to jerk them around like this. The hedge funds are going to get hit pretty hard if they don't play it the right way. So, you know, I think long term, I'm not sure. Well, it'll never get back to the frenzy it was. I don't think we'll suddenly have the next, you know, meme stock will be as big as, you know, GameStop was back then. But it doesn't have to be for it to change the way markets operate. You know, mm-hmm. it can have an impact without taking over the headlines of every paper.
I mean, definitely a new power dynamic there in the investing world and institutions having to kind of take note. But then there's also the policy ramifications of what happened. And since then, now we're hearing a lot more about payment for order flow. That is the wholesaling of trades en masse through market makers to help do so as cheap as possible. That's getting a lot more scrutiny in the US and especially so in Europe. But whether we'll see any big policy changes here, that remains to be seen. I think the other big thing, though, of course, is, as we've just seen from the SEC, there's going to be demand for more disclosure and transparency with short selling. And that's probably going to be a pretty big implication for institutions.
Yeah, and just getting back to the payment for order flow aspect of it, I don't think that will change much in the US here, but you know, there are some pretty honest questions being asked about it. Like you have these entities paying money for information, and we're supposed to believe that they're not benefiting from that? These are smart people paying money for information. Why would they pay money for that information if they weren't going to be able to monetize it in some way? Mm-hmm. Like that whole premise is pretty crazy. There's also some folks, I mean, that there was an investigation into the relationship between, you know, Robinhood and Citadel and some of the other entities and whether they colluded and all this whole thing. And when Robinhood was freezing, you know, retail traders out of their accounts, that investigation found that there was no collusion. But there are people out there who still kind of think that, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, you don't have to have, you know, the text thread or the email or the phone records of the actual communication. If your neighbor's house is on fire, you look out the window, you don't have to wait for them to call you or send you a text, please help. You know, it's in your best interest to go help. So, but yeah, the investigation found there was no wrongdoing there, you know, and Robinhood and other, you know, platforms like that are still wildly popular and going to get even more popular.
You do at least see their users now understanding a little better what commission free trading really means and where the money comes from to actually conduct such a business.
So that's a wrap up of our top Smart Brief 7 stories that Colin and I like the most this year. We will in the show notes include a list of the top 10 stories from the Modern Money Smart Brief, and that's just determined based on clicks from readers like you. Colin, any other thoughts as we wrap up the year here?
It's definitely been a big year for individual investors. It's definitely been a big year for crypto investors. We're still coming off the effects of the 2020 pandemic, but I think we've got a lot to look forward to in 2022 and a lot of policy developments to be watching.
Yeah, we definitely have an exciting 2022 to look forward to. I'm going to keep my eye on the sustainable investing side of it, and climate finance is a big puzzle that we all have to work out, and you know, watching some of the leading firms and how they tackle that is something I'm going to keep a keen eye on. But for now, happy holidays to all our listeners. We look forward to coming back to you in 2022 with more episodes of the Modern Money Smart Pod.
That's our show for today. But before we get out of here, we just want to say a quick thank you to the exclusive sponsor of today's episode, ICE.
If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and colleagues. And be sure to follow us on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ModernMoneyPod. And if you'd like a daily dose of Modern Money news delivered to your inbox, head on over to smartbrief.com and sign up for the Modern Money Smart Brief. The Modern Money Smart Pod is a production of Smart Brief, a future company.